It's currently on a Verizon. We'll get it in between services. You may be opening up to 2 Samuel chapter 17. 2 Samuel chapter 17. It's good to see everyone this morning. It's a beautiful day outside. Don't know how long it'll stay that way, but it's beautiful right now, and that's all any of us have. It's wonderful to be able to be here this morning to worship the Lord and to study from His Word. And to those who are with us on live stream, you probably have noticed and probably are noticing the poor quality of the live stream. So we're going to have to work on that in between Bible class and worship services. So please bear with us patiently in regard to that. And hopefully at least the audio will be able to come across and you'll be able to follow along in our Bible class this morning. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 17, just to kind of give you an idea of what's been happening as we're picking up with the Absalom narrative and probably going to finish with that and push into the discussion questions as well regarding Absalom. Chapter 16 closed out with David on the run. Absalom had begun a coup in Hebron, and that's really started to manifest. He's gathered armies, he's traveled around, he's gained a following. Much of Israel seems to be in popular support of Absalom as the next king. And David, by the time he realizes what's happening, finds out that he's got to evacuate Jerusalem, or else he's going to be ousted by Absalom and probably killed. So David, with a handful of loyal followers and with his personal guard, the Cherethites and Pelethites, 500 or 600 men, I believe, somewhere in that neighborhood, relatively small group considering what he's up against. They flee Jerusalem. And along the way, as they're going up the Mount of Olives, David is weeping, and all the people are weeping because of the events that have transpired. He runs into a man named Hushai. Hushai is one of David's two primary counselors whenever he was in Jerusalem. Hushai tells him that Ahithophel has turned on him. Ahithophel was David's primary counselor, and chapter 16 ends by saying, the counsel of Ahithophel was as if someone consulted the Lord himself for advice. And so Hushai's word was very effective, very powerful, and very influential in regard to the king. Ahithophel, and we see the reason that he turned on him, at least in part, was because he was Bathsheba's grandfather. Okay, not to go back and rehash all of that. But Ahithophel has essentially betrayed David, and he's working now with Absalom. And so David prays for God to turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Actually, it's not Hushai that brings the news. It's revealed to David that that is the case. David prays, and then I think he runs into Hushai a little bit later. Okay, and so remember where we left off. Ahithophel had counseled Absalom whenever he said, what should we do? He had counseled Absalom to go into all of his father's concubines in the presence of all of the people in Jerusalem. And the result was that this would really sever the final relationship that David could have ever had with reconciliation. This would show in a demonstrative way that Absalom was taking over as king, that he had taken David's wives to be his wives, and that he was assuming the throne along with everything that David had previously had. Okay, so after this public display with his father's concubines, Ahithophel comes to him and proposes a plan that will solidify the coup. Now remember, Ahithophel is the one who has betrayed David, and he is the one who is advising Absalom, a very wise man. And he says to Absalom, give me 12,000 men, and I'll go after David tonight. He's going to be weary and weak, and if I kill the king, we can limit the collateral damage of an all-out civil war. And Absalom said, that's a great idea, but first let's ask Hushai what we should do. Now, Hushai's advice is very different than Absalom's. Back in chapter 15, remember, David prayed whenever he finds out Ahithophel has betrayed him, Lord, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. So we're about to see that happen. Hushai knows that David is weak. Remember, he's been in touch with David. He's seen the morale. He's seen what David has. He's seen the circumstances. He knows that David is weak. And David sends him back to infiltrate Absalom's cabinet and to essentially corrupt the advice of Ahithophel. And so when Hushai is asked by Absalom what he should do, he reminds him of David's great prowess in battle. And he essentially said, if you run into David, if you go looking for him right now, you know your father's a mighty man of war. He is going to be like a bear robbed of his cubs. He is going to be angry. He's going to be backed into a corner, and he's got nothing else to fight for. And so he's going to fight for his life. You don't want to do that. And so what he advises him to do is he says, what you ought to do is you need to go gather the armies of Israel. Go throughout all the territories of Israel. Bring his great army back. And what he's doing is he's playing off of Absalom's pride. I don't know if you noticed that or not, but he's playing off of Absalom's pride. Remember, Absalom's a very vain man, handsome man. He likes the theatrics. He likes the flamboyant. Okay, Ahithophel says, put me in charge. I'll go take David out. But Hushai says, no, Absalom, you need to lead the charge. Go gather this big army and then just go in. You lead the army. You save the day. You crush your father. Okay, and so he's convincing him to put on this very theatrical display of power to defeat David and his enemies. And he says, don't send a small army because David will defeat them. That'll give them pride. The people will be strengthened, and eventually this will all fall to pieces. So rather than letting Ahithophel lead, he encourages Absalom himself to lead the men into battle. Now look down in verses 12 and 13 of 2 Samuel 17. So we shall come upon him, that is, he's speaking to Absalom about the army, we shall come upon him in some place where he is to be found. We shall light upon him as the dew falls on the ground, and of him and all the men with him, not one will be left. If he withdraws into a city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we shall drag it into the valley, and not even a pebble is to be found there. Okay, so he's playing off of Absalom's pride, and he's playing off of Absalom's vanity. So that's what Hushai is suggesting he do. Go and gather a big army, track David down, and if he runs to hide in a city, just bring the entire city down on David's head. And he says, don't let Ahithophel get the glory. You lead the men into battle, and you do this yourself. Now look at verse 14, because I think this is a really key passage in understanding the events that are happening and seeing the sovereign hand of God that is superintending all of these things. Free will, not being restricted in any way. There is standing behind these events a sovereign God who has a plan. You see it in verse 14 as it's identified. And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. Why? For the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom. Okay, this is part of God's plan. It's part of God's plan for Absalom to fall. Part of God's plan for Absalom to be defeated. Part of God's plan involved Ahithophel's counsel being turned into foolishness as David had prayed. And so we see here the demonstration of God's sovereignty operating within the confines of man's free will. God is sovereign, and he has ordained for Absalom to die. Now, whether God inclined the heart of Absalom and the people to Hushai's plan, or whether it was simply his smooth talking and those things which convinced Absalom to take this advice, it happened according to the will of God. And that's what the narrator makes clear. This happened because it was God's will for harm to fall upon Absalom. So remember that proverb. The heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord, and he turns it whichever way he wishes. Okay, and we see that fulfilled here in this particular instance. So after succeeding in convincing Absalom to follow his plan, Hushai then sends word to David so that David can be prepared to launch a counterattack against Absalom's army and finally put an end to the rebellion. So remember, he's got the two priests, Abiathar and Zadok, who are loyal to him. And so he sends word by their sons, the priest's sons, to David, hey, Absalom's gathering an army, this is his plan, and giving David that information, David can then prepare to retaliate and won't be caught off guard by Absalom's strike. All right, question number 9. What request did David make of his generals regarding Absalom? Not to kill him. 2 Samuel chapter 18, verse 15. Well, that's where, verse 5, 2 Samuel 18 and verse 5. The request of David is, the king ordered Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave orders to the commanders about Absalom. So, after everything that Absalom has done, David still loves him. Miss Johnny, do you want to comment? He's telling them no one touch Absalom? Right. He wanted them to deal gently with Absalom. He wanted them to bring, obviously, he wanted his men to bring Absalom back alive. He doesn't want him to do any harm. You know, after everything that Absalom has done to David, you might would expect something different. Maybe you wouldn't. I think about it as a parent. I sympathize with David very much. I think if I were in David's position, I probably would have said the same thing. Because you always, as a parent, you will always love your children. And there's an important lesson I think that we can gain as we're here in this text. I was sitting with the girls, I guess it was a few weeks ago, And we were studying through 2 Samuel, kind of just reading and talking about the story, so forth and so on. And we got to this part here about Absalom. And I looked at them and I told them, no matter what you do, mommy and daddy will always love you. There's nothing that my children could do that could stop me from loving them. And if you're the parent that God would have you to be, the same is true for you. There is nothing that your children could do that could make you ever stop loving them. Now, that doesn't mean you approve of everything that they do. Doesn't mean you support everything that they do. It just means you will unconditionally love them no matter what they do because they are your children. And I told Annabelle and Lillian, God's love for us is like David's love for Absalom. You see, like Absalom, we've done all these terrible things against God. We've sinned against God and mocked God and humiliated God and scorned God's love and belittled God and shamed him. We're not worthy of the love, just as Absalom is not worthy of his father's love. We are not worthy of God's love, but yet God loves us. And some of the saddest verses in the whole Bible is when word is brought to David of his son's death. Just look down real quickly at chapter 18, verses 31, starting. This is after Absalom has been killed. Behold, the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, "Good news for my lord, the king, for the Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all of those who rose up against you." The king said to the Cushite, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" And the Cushite answered, "May the enemies of my lord, the king, and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man." And the king was deeply moved, and he went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would that I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son." And I looked at my children and I told them, God's love for us isn't like David's love for his son. As much as David loved Absalom, God's love for us is infinitely greater. You see, David would have died so that Absalom could have lived. Having done all of these things against him, David would have died so that Absalom could have lived. But God was willing to die so that we who have done all of these terrible things against our father can have life. So David was not able to do and to demonstrate that ultimate love, but God was. And just reading this, I see the love that God has for humanity, the love that God has for particularly his children through faith, those who belong to him. And we understand that in the same way, while we don't approve of our children, everything that they do, when they make mistakes, when they go astray from God's word, what I'm simply focusing here is on the love that God has. Now, I understand there have been people who've taken the love of God and they've just gone far off into left field and drawn erroneous conclusions about love and God's expectation for us to be obedient. And God will tolerate whatever you do. No, God's love is unconditional. However, God's promises that we read in Scripture are very often conditional. And yes, God's love will love us through whatever it is we do, but there is also the expectation that we act in accordance with that. And as I said, my point in bringing this to your attention isn't so much to focus on the other, but just to cause us to appreciate the deep love for God, but also to caution us not to run off and draw false conclusions based off of that. Okay. Anyone want to comment on any of that? Okay. I very much appreciate the sentiment expressed here by David. And I've made it my practice as I read through Scripture, particularly as I read through the Old Testament, to look for the gospel. When you go back through the Old Testament reading, I think sometimes we have to wait till we get to the New Testament as the gospel is narrated for us about the story of Jesus. But I encourage you, reading through the Old Testament, if your eye is open to this, what you'll notice is that the gospel is on every page. When you read about Noah, when you read about Abraham, when you read about Joseph and Moses and the judges and the kings and the prophets, look for the gospel because it's on every page, you'll find it. It's like God was trying to prepare people to see Jesus so that when he stepped onto the scene, it would be very clear who he was and what he was going to do because he was the fulfillment of all of those things which had been written. Okay, so David knew that God was going to deliver him. He knew the rebellion was going to be overthrown. In spite of all the sins that Absalom had committed against his father, David still loved him and desired that his people deal gently with him. All right, question number 10. How then did Absalom meet his end?
My understanding,
my,
The three darts through his heart.
So.
Yeah. So.
Oh, the two verse after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they
said young armor bearer slew his, as they spoke.
Yeah.
You already hanging slice up at eight.
Yeah. Tell you what, let's start in verse 6 and kind of just read through the narrative, and we'll watch it as it unfolds and see how things technically end up. So the question, how did Absalom meet his end? Who killed Absalom? I'm going to agree with Dick. It was a young man. But how did he meet his end? There were some events that led up to that. Let's start in verse 6 and kind of read through those. Chapter 18. So the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forces of Ephraim. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David. And the loss there was very great on that day, 20,000 men. The battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. And Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding on his mule. And the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak. And he was suspended between heaven and earth, while the mule was under him went on. And a certain man saw it, and went to Joab, and said, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak tree." So Joab said to the man, why did you not strike him to the ground? I would be glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. But the man said to Joab, even if I had in my hand the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver, I would not have reached out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. So on the other hand, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. And Joab said, I will not waste time like this with you. And he took 3 javelins in his hand, thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. And the 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. So kind of how did Absalom meet his end? I kind of just summarized those last couple of verses. Joab took thrusting 3 spears into his heart, probably his chest, and then realizing that Absalom wasn't dead. So he then had his armor bearers fall on them and strike him down. So while it was the armor bearers who delivered the final blow, it was Joab who ultimately brought it about. So, yeah. Well, I guess I can't take any credit away from the mule. Yeah, and that kind of begs the question. You know, it's just the text says he got his head caught in the tree, and I don't know how it is for y'all. I've always thought it was his hair that got caught. Am I the only one that thought that? Okay, I always thought his hair got caught in the tree, and
he could have been either way, but hair would have, that's a good possibility.
Yeah, because you know it. You go back several chapters, and one of the things that it brings out, and it seems like the hair almost has to tie in, because what relevance is Absalom's hair being long? You know, unless it plays some part in the story, who cares about that? You know, so that's always been my assumption. I think that's how I've always heard the story told. But as I was reading it, and kind of noticing that. The details were a little bit differently. Let me see if I can find the verse. Okay, verse 9 of chapter 18. Absalom was riding on his mule. There you go, David. He was riding on his mule. The mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head was caught fast in the oak. So, I don't see any reason to question, you know, whether it was hair that got caught in there, it was kind of suspending in between heaven and earth, or whether some commentators have suspected that his head or his neck may have got caught like in the fork of a tree and he was kind of stuck there. Whatever the case was, he stuck hanging in this tree by his neck or hair or head, however you want to interpret that. He's stuck in the tree. That's what's important. He can't touch the ground. And, this young soldier comes by, sees Absalom, reports to Joab, and I kind of like the way this guy was sharp. If you think about some of the instances where someone has saw an enemy to the throne on their own, they've taken the life of the individual. Remember a little bit later on, David's got this big thing going on too. He's got this repeated theme. We kind of see, I will not touch the Lord's anointed, right? And so David, you know, I understand Absalom is not the Lord's anointed, but he wouldn't take the life of Saul, despite having multiple attempts to take the life of Saul. Whenever Saul took his own life, we know in a battle with the Philistines, there's this foreign soldier that runs and tells David, you know, here are the things of Saul. And he says, how do you know Saul is dead? And he says, well, I saw him suffering. I put him out of his misery. Here are the things. That was a lie. David realizes or thinks that to be true, and he has the young soldier killed because he killed the Lord's anointed, at least from his understanding. Okay, so David's got this thing going on, and Joab says, you saw Absalom hanging in a tree. Why didn't you just eradicate the threat right there? And the young soldier says, you heard him, David, as good as I did. He commanded you, protect his son, deal gently with Absalom. He said, and he said, if I would have taken his life, you would have stood there with your mouth shut whenever David asked why this happened. And Joab suggested the young man kill him, but he knows very well that Joab would not have stuck his neck out and say, well, he was operating on my orders. So he says, you'd have kept your mouth shut. That's why I didn't take his life. You could give me a mountain of silver, and I wouldn't do it because I heard the command of the Lord. And so Joab then goes, finds Absalom hanging in the tree, sticks three javelins into his chest. He's still kicking, and so he has his young armor bearers fall on Absalom and put an end to the threat. Thus Absalom meets his end. Matthew Henry writes, let young people look upon Absalom hanging on a tree, accursed, forsaken of heaven and earth. There let them read the abhorrence of rebellion against parents. Dad? Sure. Sure.
We need to realize that the sin is involved. Even though we may not actually participate in it, if we approve of it and are involved in it in any form or fashion, we're just as guilty of that sin as the person that commits it. So there's a lesson to us here that we don't need to touch sin, we don't need to be around it, we don't need to be a part of it, we don't need to approve of it. We need to do everything we can to put it behind us and not let it stand us in any way or form.
Well, that's a good point. I think of Paul's statement to Timothy, do not be partaker in other men's sins. You know, whether it wasn't Joab's hand per se that took the life of Absalom, but you remember whenever David sent Uriah into battle with the message to Joab, and he gave the command for Joab to put Uriah at the front and then withdraw. But when Nathan comes to him, he says, you slew Uriah with the sword of the enemy. Okay, and so he attributes it to David, although it wasn't David's hand directly. And so, yeah, we stay away from sin as far as we can on any level, because we may not be guilty of doing something per se, but there are lots of things along the way that we can do to get involved with sin, and we should just refrain from it completely. Good. Steve?
Some of the other instances where God, you know, God gets involved. To what degree, you know, I don't know how the people were being killed in the forest. Obviously, it was a very treacherous place, right? You got Absalom there, then you've got the forest who devoured more people than the soldiers did, and so you kind of see that throughout history, or the old history of the Old Testament is God would oftentimes use, say, I think it's the Battle of Sisera in the Book of Judges. Where as they're traveling along in their chariots, and that was their power, as they're traveling along in their chariots, they're going through some terrain, and the chariot wheels fall off. You know, and so you see kind of God involving himself in the battle in a natural way, if you will. And so whether this was God involved or whether it was just a treacherous force, you know, we don't know. But they lost a lot of men that day. 20,000 were killed with the sword. More died in the forest. I can only wonder how that happened. But it was a sad day for Israel.
Soldiers. So the Americans, you know, wasn't killing them. Well, there's a lot of places that die, and they could have fallen off the cliff, they could have been snake bit, they could have been attacked by wild animals, starved to death, they could have died of dehydration.
As Dustin told us when she went out, there's more than one way to skin a cat, right? So, all right, let's get into our first discussion question.
One more thought.
All right.
Joab, this is speculating. Joab, I think Joab was going to make sure somewhere or another that Absalom didn't make it out of here. Because when he found out about the deal, he had hoped somebody would kill him so he wouldn't have to tell David. But he ultimately.
One thing about Joab, when you read about him.
He's
loyal to David, but you think if he were loyal to David, he would have kept what David said, right? But one of the things about Joab, he's loyal to Joab. He's loyal to three people. He's loyal to Joab. He's loyal to David, and he was loyal to the nation of Israel. And I think in his mind, he probably weighed, you know, the consequences of leaving Absalom alive, returning him to David, what that would do to the nation. He probably weighed that about having to deal with the consequences of killing Absalom, and said, okay, it's better to just remove the threat. You know, and we understand, if Absalom would have been left alive, who knows?
My thought would have happened. Exactly that, but he didn't make that decision when that guy said, hey, he's hanging in a tree over there.
Yeah.
I think he was going to make sure Absalom.
Yeah, I think so too.
I wish we knew more.
One day, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we'll find
that. All right. So, thus ends the Absalom narrative, thus ends Absalom. So, let's kind of go back, and we may not be able to get through this, but I want to touch on discussion question number one. So, Amnon committed an unspeakable crime against Tamar's sister Absalom. So remember, way back in the beginning of our study, Amnon, half-brother to Absalom, half-brother to Tamar. We remember the situation in the events that followed there where Amnon desired Tamar, ended up raping her and sending her away and in horrified and ashamed. So while Absalom's violent response is understandable, God forbids personal vengeance. And we may have to, Tommy, we talked about this, so we can just kind of leave this behind, maybe visit with it more along the way. So more so the question is the application I want to touch for this day and age. And as certainly today, you know, God forbids personal vengeance. So, vengeance is mine, Romans chapter 12, I will repay. Leave vengeance to the hand of God. So in the context of today, how can one go about forgiving someone who has committed a heinous crime against them or someone that they love? And let me first say, this is not by any means to undermine the pain or the suffering that someone has suffered on behalf of an unspeakable crime or sin that has been committed against them. There may be some here who have suffered under such things or have suffered unspeakable sins committed against them. And we need to recognize and realize that every sin is going to be paid for. No punishment against you will go unpunished. It was either paid for with what Christ has done on the cross, or will be paid for when Christ returns. And as God says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. So, with that being said, how does one go about forgiving someone who has committed a heinous crime against them or against someone they love?
Take a lot of prayer.
Take a lot of prayer. All right, that's a great place to start. Tommy? Okay, that, you really bring an important passage forth where you kind of have the parable of the unforgiving servant. And Jesus kind of concludes that by saying, you know, if you don't forgive others, then your Heavenly Father won't forgive you. And so you kind of have to put it in that context. And that doesn't make forgiveness in such instances where you think of what Absalom suffered and what Tamar suffered, that doesn't make it easy. And that's, I think, ties in well with what Dick said. It takes a lot of prayer to get through something like that. And one of the things I jotted down, God's forgiveness doesn't hinge upon our willingness, hinges on our forgiveness of others. We're just going to have to pick up with this thought. I've got a couple more passages I want to bring out because of the relevance of this. But we'll pick up with our here next week. And also, I've got handouts in the back for Sarah. Sarah is our next character study, and so make sure to grab one of those. Sarah, so in preparation for our Bible class. maybe week after next, probably week after next, we might be able to touch on some of that. So get a handout. I'll try to post that online for those who are studying with us online. Make that available to you as well. So.